From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It takes nearly 400 pages for the journalists Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes to work through what happened in the 2016 presidential race. And that's only Hillary Clinton's part, which is pretty involved. As you know, you lived it with everyone else. Her battle with Bernie Sanders, her inability to connect with working-class white voters, her email server, James Comey, the Russians. Allen and Parnes spoke with dozens of Clinton campaign insiders, most of them anonymous sources. And what they found is that there are a lot of reasons Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. But she struggled to take responsibility for her own part in the defeat. Today in the program, the story of the Clinton campaign. The book is called Shattered. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As it began to dawn on her that she had lost the 2016 presidential campaign to Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton became stoic. In their new book, the political journalists Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes described this part of the evening. Clinton's voice was quiet, they write, her face expressionless. When aides approached her with new information, she would respond briefly and with no emotion. "Okay," she would say, over and over that night. Parnes and Allen say, like the rest of the Democrats in the world, Hillary Clinton was in a state of shock. They also say that at a deeper level, she wasn't completely surprised, that over the course of her life, she was always waiting for the other shoe to drop. In the book, they recount all that she had managed to do that year, defeat Bernie Sanders, win back the support of African-American voters. She had drawn the opponent she wanted. She had won the debates. But still, there was this dark mantra in the campaign coined by one of her aides: "We're not allowed to have nice things." Today in the program, Allen and Parnes are joining us to talk about Clinton's doomed campaign. The book is called Shattered. Amy Parnes is the senior White House correspondent for The Hill in Washington. She joined us from a studio in Newark, New Jersey. Jonathan Allen is the head of content at the political news site Sidewire. He's also a columnist at Roll Call. He was in NPR's studios in Washington. We began by talking about their first idea for this book. This is actually the second one they've written about Hillary Clinton.
We had written another book a few years ago called HRC that examined her time at the State Department and delved into the lessons she learned from her first campaign for president and how she went on to work for President Obama. And so this book seemed like the next obvious thing for us to do. We wanted to know what lessons she had learned from the campaign, how she would apply those lessons to this campaign, how the campaign would be different than the last campaign. And so I think that's what we aim to do. We wanted to answer those questions. And it's a different kind of book. Our first book is really focused on her time at state and governance. And this one was her management of a campaign.
You talk about how Hillary Clinton had, this is how you put it, every imaginable institutional advantage as she went into this. She was bulletproof, I think how David Plouf put it. So everything's in place, but you say that you were surprised that even by 2015, that Hillary Clinton was still struggling to articulate her motivation for seeking the presidency. Talk about that.
That's one of the big factors we believe in her being in the position to lose an election that you know she was essentially the favorite for throughout. There were very few days on the calendar where Donald Trump led her in the polls. I think right after the Republican convention, and then maybe right at the end of his primary when he was wrapping that up, and she was still involved in her primary. You know, she struggled with trying to define for people what it was she was going to do for them in a way that they believed that it was about them rather than being about her. And when I say people, I mean, obviously, American voters are not a monolith. But I think in terms of the people whom she was unable to persuade to come to her side, Some of them never would have come, but there were some who were persuadable. And, you know, we sort of go through in the book her first big speech on Roosevelt Island in New York in June of 2015. And it was a real mess of an effort by her staff and by some people outside, including Jon Favreau, the former Obama speechwriter, to try to come up with a narrative for her and to really knock a speech out of the park, to the point that Favreau got so frustrated he threw his hands up in the air and left before the speech was done and, you know, went off to deal with some business clients. And one of her senior aides said to us, I would have had a reason for running or I wouldn't have run. And the inability to even, you know, internally have the people closest to her know what this campaign was about that was larger than her is indicative of the problem she had telling other people that.
I wanted to ask you about, I wanted to get a couple of things out of the way here first. And one of them is the narrative that I think came out after the election or even during about there being no, you know, no drama really going on within the campaign. You said that turned out to be pretty wrong, and you were surprised by the level of infighting. And you spent a lot of time talking about that because I guess most of the public didn't see that drama is one of the reasons there was this narrative.
Yeah, and I think one of the big takeaways from the 2008 campaign was that there was a lot of infighting, and more than that, the infighting was splashed all over the all over newspapers and the cable networks. And I think one of the main things this time around was that they wanted to avoid that or the perception of that. And so, but you, what in reality you had there was infighting at the very top. John Podesta, the campaign chairman, and Robbie Mook, the campaign manager, didn't really like each other all that much. One of them thought the other one was passive-aggressive and said as much. Podesta, in a senior staff meeting over the summer of 2016, calls him that in front of his other colleagues. And then you have the creation of what is called the Super Six, as John likes to call it. It's sort of like a board of directors where six different people actually manage the campaign. And so I think, you know, a lot of people didn't really know about that. This was unreported until our book. But it's interesting to see what was kind of swept under the rug. You know, they like to portray it as this quote-unquote joyful campaign. But I think there was a lot of, there was infighting at the top and a lot of responsibilities taken away from people in key moments and moments when she was losing.
You spoke to a lot of people. And most of them, as you point out a couple of times actually in the book, spoke with you exclusively on background. Talk a little bit about making that decision, because clearly when you're a journalist and you have to do that kind of reporting, there are some trade-offs. So how are you thinking about that? Because you made this decision right at the beginning of the process, I guess.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that were really important to being able to get folks to talk to us. Number one, was the promise to not take anything out from what they said and report it. And I think there's just no way that any of these people would have talked to us if they felt like the things they were telling us were going to affect the outcome of the election. They were way too nervous about that. I think we had built up a reservoir of trust in that we had done a previous book and no one felt like we had been dishonest with them about, you know, about what we were up to. And then, you know, the other important thing was doing all of these, doing all of it anonymously. I think there was a tremendous fear of potential retribution if Secretary Clinton won the presidency and could go through the book and figure out, you know, who said what. And so I think, you know, and justified fear because she had gone through the emails of her senior staffers after the 2008 campaign to see who'd been stabbing her in the back. And so these two
Jonathan,
things,
can you just hold for just will you underline that point? That's a kind of an extraordinary point to make. She basically, I'm not sure what the politic word is, but kind of snooped on these exchanges within her campaign in 2008. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's one of the revelations of this book that after 2008, she was trying to put together a post-mortem on what happened. And basically, she had her IT staffer download the emails from her senior staff's you know, inboxes on her, you know, on the campaign server. and deliver them to her so that she could see what these people were saying to each other. And it's interesting, you know, sort of in light of what happened with her private server. Obviously, she understands the power that comes with being able to snoop in, into other people's email and the vulnerability you have when others are looking at your private email messages. And, you know, I think it sort of goes to the question of, you know, what exactly she was trying to do with her email server when she set up the private one in the first place. And Amy and I believe the answer to that is to avoid having to have all of her, her email subject to Freedom of Information Act requests and basically public review. We all know how that turned out. It backfired pretty badly on her. But yeah, I mean, there is a fair amount of paranoia in Clinton world, and it starts with Secretary Clinton. And because of the way she behaves, I think the people around her also behave that way. They don't want to say anything that will get them at odds with her. And that's not just publicly. That's not just with reporters. This was a problem internally, too.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things didn't make it up the chain. Or if they did make it up the chain, anybody who was raising hackles about something, you know, was fearful that it would be, you know, bad for them. Going forward, her closest aide, Huma Abedin, a lot of people didn't trust her, felt like if they said something wasn't going right, that Abedin would report to Hillary that this person was causing trouble rather than necessarily relaying the information.
That kind of brings up a moment. I was going to wait to get to it, but let's talk about the primary loss that occurs in Michigan, which you kind of describe as the after effect of all of this is this kind of reckoning. And you described the fact that you say it was a self-signed death warrant to raise a question about Hillary's competence to her or anyone else. Now, we can come back to the Michigan story itself, but explain that idea, because I think that's kind of what you were getting at, that there no one dared really say the difficult things at certain moments in this campaign.
Yeah, and we saw that in many cases. There were people who wanted Hillary to know what was happening on the ground, and they would relay a message to Huma Abedin, her close aide. And it never really got across to Hillary, never went through to her for whatever reason. And so I think we saw this time and again from the ground and the grassroots organization on the ground that had been developed in several states, and how people didn't have the basic things they needed, even down to law signs. And they were constantly trying to sound the alarm from the very beginning of the primary, kind of saying, we don't have what we need here. And you had people in Colorado and other key states saying the same thing, that we're being sent to into war without armor. And I think that was a problem for the campaign, and their ground game was affected because of it.
There's a theme, a constant theme, it seems like, in the book, and it brings it. I think it's reflected in this story that happens after the primary loss, or in the moments related to this primary loss in Michigan. And you tell this story in the book where Hillary Clinton kind of humiliates her strategist, Jake Sullivan. And they were prepping for this debate in Miami. This would have been a debate with Bernie Sanders. And Sullivan had said in response to one of her answers, you know, they were preparing, and he said, that's not very good. And she kind of humiliates him. Would you tell this story? Because I think this is kind of indicative of some things.
So she's come out of the Michigan primary having been defeated narrowly by Bernie Sanders. The media narrative from that is that he has rebounded. He is Lazarus, risen from the dead and ready to make a long run at her through the primary campaign. She knew that she had not connected with Michigan voters the way that she wanted to. She knew that pretty much everything had fallen apart, you know, from her messaging to the data analytics team, the polling, everything was off. They knew that it was going to be close. They didn't realize she was going to lose. She put a ton of effort into it. She lost anyway. She's humiliated. She's frustrated. She's angry. And Jake Sullivan, her policy director, who eventually becomes her chief strategist on the campaign, is, you know, going through debate prep with her. And she'll test out a line, and he'll interject and say, that's not good. You need to do it a little differently. That's bad. And finally, she's had it. And she says, you know what? If it's so easy, you try it.
Right.
And she makes him go through the rest of the debate prep, about another half hour of it anyway, basically playing her.
Yeah.
And she starts peppering him with lines from Bernie Sanders. This is not, you know, it's funny to us sitting back many months later, but certainly not funny in the room at that moment.
Yeah.
She was very angry.
Yeah.
You know, this is a thoughtful person. She signals just how angry she is by going after Sullivan, because he's basically her favorite. I mean, this is somebody she adores. She has said before that she thinks he's going to be a president of the United States someday.
Yeah.
Somebody she's really taken under her wing. And, you know, she just loves Jake Sullivan. And for her to turn on him in this meeting in front of, you know, a bunch of other, in this debate prep session, in front of a bunch of other people, was really telling about just how angry she was. And then, you know, she tries during that day, you know, at that moment and other parts during that day, to really try to find out what happened in Michigan. And she's not liking the answer she's getting.
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't feel like her team's just up to snuff. And so this was not the only time she got frustrated or angry on the campaign trail, but it was a particularly caustic moment.
But you write, the one person with whom she didn't seem particularly upset was herself. You say, and no one would tell her that. And this is the theme that I was referring to. Because you write early on in the book that she had learned a lot of lessons from losing in 2008. But the idea burned into her mind, you say, most, was that she had lost because she had hired people who put their own interests above getting her elected. And it seems like the theme is not willing to take her own kind of responsibility, but always, it seems, throughout this process, blame someone else, blame the team.
Right. And we have one scene in the book that is kind of indicative of that, where it's the summer of 2015. So she's already announced her candidacy. She's in the thick of it. And the email controversy is looming large over her campaign. And she is frustrated with her aides that they haven't gotten their her economic message across. And why, she's saying, why hasn't it broken through? And she's on a call with a lot of her aides, and her husband's on the call as well. And they're basically telling the aides to get it together. And at that moment, she didn't really own the fact that she was responsible for the email controversy. And her aides internally, John Podesta being one of them, were trying to get her to come, you know, get out in front of it and to own responsibility for it and to apologize. And she and her husband were kind of reluctant initially to do that because they thought that they had done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to a lot of where she was during the campaign, and that she didn't quite accept responsibility for the fact that things were going wrong.
One of the things that comes across from time to time is this lack of a kind of ability or a willingness to apologize. And it seems like in some ways she's pretty much influenced by Bill Clinton. He thought that was a weakness, saying you're sorry.
I think it depends on the moment. You know, Bill Clinton is somebody who himself has made contrition and redemption its own art form.
That's true.
You know, I mean, he spent a lot of time indignantly denying that he did anything wrong, and then
yeah.
figured out once the game was up, just how to plead for everyone's forgiveness. She has not figured that out. I do think his instinct is initially to fight things and to try to explain why you did what you did if you think you didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And she didn't think she'd done anything wrong. I think she looks at that from a lawyer's perspective of, if it's not explicitly forbidden and there's no penalty attached to it, then it must be legal. And, you know, I think what voters were looking at was, you know, not the question of whether it's technically legal or illegal or technically within the rules or outside the rules, but whether it's right or wrong. And, you know, they clearly, over the course of that summer, her inability to seek forgiveness, to acknowledge what she'd done wrong, her several interviews that it took before, you know, while she sort of came through an evolution of getting to sorry, nobody believed her by the time she apologized. It had no value, and it was not strong enough. And she had done so much damage to herself over that period of time by insisting that she'd done nothing wrong, when clearly the public had decided that she had. And, you know, I think Bill Clinton felt like Bill Clinton might have been able to explain it or might have been able to lean into it a little better. But, you know, he was the last domino to fall in terms of walking away from the idea that she ought to stick to her guns on it. Basically, everybody on our campaign staff thought she ought to apologize, but he wouldn't do it. She wouldn't do it. And then finally, you know, he sort of saw the light on that and she saw the light on it.
I was interested in early on as she is trying to they're getting ready to make this launch. All of these conversations and preparations about how we go about this. And it's interesting that she was dragging her feet early on about making things official. And it was frustrating some of the members of that early staff. Like she wasn't quite ready, which, you know, she had been like getting ready for this moment all her life. And it did make me wonder, are you guys convinced that she really did want to run really deeply?
Yeah, I think she wanted to run because she knows or she thinks that she has great policy ideas and she's well versed in policy and she is. She's a wonk. And we learned that in our first book. She's a student. She comes prepared. But the one thing that she didn't prepare for was the reason, the rationale for why she should be president. Yeah. And I think that frustrated a lot of people internally. And, you know, John quoted someone earlier, a senior advisor, who basically said she should have had a reason for running or she shouldn't have run. And I think that speaks to all of it. But I think she does feel like, and you heard some of this recently in her interview that she gave with Christiane Amanpour, where she feels like she was the one who came prepared to be president. She came prepared for the debates. And she thinks that she would be the right person to be president because she knows governance and she knows how to run a bureaucracy. And so I do think that she prepared for this. But yeah, she just didn't really give people a reason for why she should be president.
I think she wanted to be president. Whether she wanted to run for it or not is another question. She does not like campaigning. And it was clear, I think, to voters, certainly on the campaign trail, and it was, you know, clear from some of the behind-the-scenes stuff we were picking up on that this was not somebody who was a happy warrior on the campaign trail. She doesn't like this part of it.
Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes, their book is Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the political journalists Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. They're talking about their book, Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. They explore what happened behind the scenes and how Clinton has struggled to take responsibility for her loss. You write about how the campaign was just this collection of tribes, and you even break down the various tribes. I think at some point in the book you describe it, a lot of chieftains, no real kind of structure. And almost a team, you say, that she designed to feud. Talk a little bit about that, the kind of silos and tribes in the Clinton campaign.
Well, so she, the Clinton world is this vast universe of people to begin with, even before this campaign officially started, because you have her world and you have Bill Clinton's world, and they don't easily mesh together as one might think. But then you add the dynamic of the Obama people coming in, and you have, because she wanted to insert fresh blood into this campaign, that was one of the things she learned from the last time. But then you have her folks from the State Department, and you have other long-term Clinton aides who had worked for her when she was senator and when she was first lady. And so you bring all these people together in one organization, and they don't always, they're not always moving in the same direction. And I think that was problematic. So you had sort of her long-term folks kind of feuding with some State Department folks, And you had the Obama people. You had people even like Robbie Mook, who had been brought in, who wasn't, you know, he worked on her 2008 campaign, but he's not, he hadn't worked for her for a very long time. So you bring all these people together, and it's no wonder that Robbie Mook and John Podesta don't get along, and why some of the other people, why there was a tension kind of with, you know, on the communication staff and other staffs in the campaign.
Let me ask you about the, you'd mentioned Jon Favreau, who they enlisted to help early on, and he just gets so frustrated. You say that even the ringer, Favreau, had to work through this committee and this speech writing process. Talk a little bit about that, because it seems very strange, very convoluted, sort of.
So there was a main speech writer, and there were other speech writers in the campaign, a communications director, consultants, chief strategist, a wide variety of people, not only inside the campaign but outside the campaign, were consulted for their ideas on what she should say. And the main speech writer, Dan Schwerin, tried to put together a speech. But he had to get all this input from all these various places, and he had to get it cleared by a variety of different people internally, and they didn't like what he was putting together. And of course, the biggest problem was that Hillary Clinton didn't know how to articulate what it was that she was going to promise the American public, you know, sort of the one big idea that animated her campaign. But, you know, they're struggling to try to put that together for her. You know, one person who was on a conference call about all this said, you know, that no one on the conference call raised the question of why you, why now? And, you know, was sort of marveling at the inability of this set of people, and particularly the candidate herself, to just come up with a basic theme for her candidacy. So they're going through these speech machinations, and it's not going very well. And Hillary taps Lisa Muscatine, mm-hmm. who was her speechwriter in the White House, and Jon Favreau, the Obama speechwriter, to sort of do a parallel draft, or they had been enlisted to kind of work on the thing, and they decide to do a parallel draft. They write their own draft. The campaign doesn't like it. They're trying to merge pieces of it. It's just like a total Frankenstein's monster of a speech. And Favreau was so accustomed, after working with Obama, to really just go in, talk to the president, have the president say what he wanted his speech to say. Favreau would go back and work on it and write it and come back. And, you know, Obama would take a red pen and make a few corrections. But, you know, it was a very streamlined process. So Favreau looks at this disaster and he's like, well, look, there's kind of, there's no mission here. And there are like a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And he basically decides he doesn't want to stir the broth anymore. Yeah. And just gives up.
It's interesting. You write about New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders, of course, just kills her by like 22 points. And you say even though she had hidden her emotions about New Hampshire, she was demoralized and angry after all of that. And she figured that the battle with Sanders, which you write a lot about, obviously, and we'll come back to that a bit. She figures that after New Hampshire that this is going to go all the way to the convention, all the way to July. And she said this. She said, we should have figured out a way to deal with Bernie earlier. And I wondered, what do you think she could have or should have done to deal with Bernie Sanders earlier? Did you find anything out in your reporting about that?
Well, for one thing, they should have seen him coming. Right. I think it took them a really long time to figure out that he was for real and that he had a movement and energy behind his campaign. I think for the longest time, even when we were reporting the book in the early stages, people kind of laughed when his name was brought up. Yeah. But it wasn't until December of 2015 when they start looking at numbers and they start realizing that he's right at their backs and he has somehow found a way to be competitive, that they really start to take him seriously. And so I think going in to Iowa, they start realizing, and then in New Hampshire, after she's blown away, she kind of has this moment that we talk about in the book, and she's flying with one of her longtime confidants, Mignon Moore, and she's essentially talking about this exact thing and what's happening behind the populism behind Bernie Sanders and the energy he's tapped into. And she doesn't get it. And she tells her longtime aide, I can't wrap my arms around what's happening. And so I think while she thinks that they could have dealt with him earlier, I think that I think she wasn't the right candidate for the time to begin with. I think people wanted change. They wanted a change candidate, and she wasn't bringing that to them. And even though I think she tried to kind of tweak her message and she went from breaking barriers to other things, it never quite took off, and she never had that same energy behind her candidacy, and it showed in the crowd size and what people wanted from Bernie Sanders.
It's interesting. You say that, as she says to Mignon Moore, that, I don't know what's happening with the country. I can't get my arms around it. You say Bill Clinton didn't really get it either. One of Hillary Clinton's advisors told you that Bill Clinton had this perception of politics, which is very much like the 1990s. And I wanted to ask you about that. It seems like their idea was kind of dated. Is it fair to say that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure that they necessarily, Bill and Hillary Clinton necessarily share a view of politics all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think there are parts of what he was doing that seemed dated to the people around him. Particularly his desire to persuade people who disagreed with her or were on the fence rather than focusing on turning out people who agreed. I think that I think that some of the things he was doing appeared to other people to be sort of throwbacks and practicing an old politics. And in his view, he was practicing a more stable and eternal politics that was perhaps coming back into vogue. It depends on the situation, but oftentimes he found himself out of step with the campaign. The fact that they ended up losing in some instances makes him look like he was the wise one and other people were perhaps less wise. One example that is pretty indicative of the fights that they were having internally, where Bill Clinton was essentially going up against the Robbie Mook wing of the campaign. Mm. Mook was making decisions about where to send Bill Clinton and how to spend money and whether they should just do turnout or try to persuade people. And they ended up doing almost exclusively turnout and very little on persuasion.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton wanted to go out and persuade people. It was so in October, and the Democrats don't talk a lot about this because they obviously want to preserve Obamacare. But in October of 2016, down the stretch run, you had a situation where Obamacare premium increases were being announced all over the country. And Bill Clinton was at an event, and, pardon my impression here, but he said, Obamacare is the craziest thing. And then, proceeded to explain how it needed to be changed. And the campaign freaked out. They didn't want the message that Obamacare was the craziest thing.
Yeah.
They were trying to get Obama voters to come out to the polls. And what Bill Clinton was doing, he got his hands, wrapped, his knuckles wrapped for it and, basically came away and didn't do that again. But I think what was going on with Bill Clinton was, if you're going to convince somebody who isn't with you to vote for you or who is worried about your policies, you're going to have to acknowledge what they're afraid of. You're going to have to acknowledge what it is that they don't like about what you're doing. And in the case of Obamacare, rising premiums, saying that they're the craziest thing in the world is a reasonably relatable, down-to-earth way to start the conversation about how you have to change things.
Yeah.
Now, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both would have also said that you have to make changes to Obamacare. That was part of the platform. But the way Bill said it, which was intended, I think, to reach a different audience than Hillary's base, the campaign suddenly thought, hey, this is a problem for us. And they went in the other direction. I think if she could have found some more votes from persuadable, non-educated white voters in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, she might have been the president.
But this brings up another theme that I detected in the book, and that there are these two camps in the Clinton campaign. On one side you have those like Robbie Mook, it seems, who figured it was kind of a waste of money to try these you know, traditional door-knocking, face-to-face efforts. And then you have Bill Clinton, who's like, yeah, you need to get out in front of people. And this becomes an issue, obviously, in Michigan and in Wisconsin, not the, the Clinton campaign being unwilling to actually go to some of these places. But then there's the other camp. You write about Clinton's, you know, young data warriors who had grown up in politics, you say, during the Obama era, and they figured they had this formula that their data was going to get them by. And it seems like this was a real contrast or conflict in that campaign.
Oh, definitely. And Bill Clinton is frustrated because he feels like, yes, you need science, but you need art, too.
Yeah.
And you need to talk to people and you need to persuade them. And so he keeps making the case that that needs to happen. And they are saying, no, that's really cute and all. But we are we've got this information. We know where we're headed. And he's told that time and again. And I think that was frustrating to him because he was getting a different feel on the ground. As you know, he likes to talk to people and get in the mix. And he's hearing from people that they aren't kind of touching all the bases and they need to be. And for whatever reason, she kind of sides with her campaign manager over her own husband. And I know that seems kind of counterintuitive, but I think a lot of it is because she likes evidence and she knows that Robbie Mook and his data people are evidence guys, and they'll give her kind of what she needs to kind of go forward and the information she needs. And so I think, and they thought, you know, that they had figured it out, and if they had kind of relied on the same models that Obama used, that they would be okay. If they were talking to African Americans, if they were making the case to the Hispanic communities, that they would be all right and that she would win. But what they did was they neglected to also talk to white working class people, and those were the same people who carried her in 2008, and she needed them this time around as well.
Yeah, one of her friends told her, everybody knows who you are, but nobody knows who you are, which is a problem, you say, kind of had dogged her throughout her public life. And I wanted to ask you about this moment that seemed like kind of could have been a turning point where she actually reveals a kind of authenticity. And it happens in Las Vegas, and where she's meeting with this group of dreamers. And this young girl talks about how frightened she was about the potential for what could happen if immigration is, you know, locked down and those kinds of things. And it's the scene of real authenticity and real intimacy. I have to say, one of the most intimate moments, I think, in the book in some ways. And I wanted you to talk about this, if you would.
So the young woman or young girl really,
yeah.
You know, talks about how she's worried about her parents being deported. And, you know, Hillary Clinton asks her to come up, and, you know, she puts her arms around the little girl, and she says, you know, you don't worry about that. That's, you know, that's something I'll worry about. And, you know, she talks about how she's going to protect people who are vulnerable to deportation or you know, other horrors of our immigration system. You know, it's something that her team realized pretty quickly was gold.
Yeah.
To get it out there. And it was a moment, I think, where you saw, you know, there's, I guess, just going back for a minute, there are so many attempts over the course of time to roll Hillary Clinton back out as something sort of new and refurbished. And usually what it is the people around her trying to layer traits onto her. And the people who are closest to her say that the real key is to get her to strip away some of her armor. And that she's somebody who's very guarded and doesn't like to let other people see her vulnerability, doesn't let like to let other people see her weakness, doesn't like to let other people see her emotion. And I think in her mind, some of those things are connected to each other. And so, you know, this was a moment where some of those layers of Hillary Clinton that existed, rather than adding on to them, this was a moment where they were stripped away. And you saw somebody who was very compassionate about this young woman, and it is a microcosm of obviously a much larger issue that, you know, for millions of American families or millions of undocumented families, as well as people who support them and you know, who care about them. And so, you know, you see this kind of emotional thing from Hillary Clinton, which is unusual for people to see in public because she doesn't like to show it.
Yeah. Which gets to the question. I mean, you know, there's another fatal flaw, of course, in the Clinton run is her lack of appeal with working class whites. And here's an irony that you point out in the book. These had been the demographic group, you said, that had been her most consistent support network when she ran in 2008. So what happened?
That's a really good question. And I think that's why, as I mentioned earlier, why Bill Clinton was so frustrated, yeah. Because he knew that they needed, instinctively, that they needed these people to turn out for her. These were the same people that supported her in 2008. She spoke to them. She met them on their level, and they liked her back then. But a lot of these people who voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012 would inevitably become Trump supporters because he was speaking to them and addressing their issues and talking about Obamacare and how it was affecting them. And for whatever reason, she thought that if she just turned out the Obama model, the African-American voters, the Hispanic voters, that they would carry her over the top. And she was mistaken.
Yeah. Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen, their book is called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalists Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. Their book is called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Let's talk about what's going on in the Clinton campaign as it becomes apparent that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican candidate. One of Hillary's longtime advisors, and I'm guessing this is probably one you quote on Background, wrote this memo, and here's what it said at the top, which you quote in the book. Fact. Donald Trump can defeat Hillary Clinton and become the 45th president of the United States, which goes to that question of whether the Clinton camp and everybody else, you know, underestimated the Trump possibility.
Yes.
Yeah. That was an easy one.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that they were thrilled to have Donald Trump as a competitor. I think they saw him as a tremendously flawed candidate. I think they could appreciate a little bit, but didn't fully appreciate the degree to which he had run through the Republican primary because he was pretty good at communicating to a certain element of the electorate and was expanding, by the way, his base as the Republican primary went on. This is not somebody who started with a strong small number and kept a strong small number. This is somebody who was rapidly expanding as the Republican nomination went on. And still, I think the Clinton people thought they had gotten as lucky as they possibly could. They were watching what was going on the Republican side, and they're like, hey, this guy who's not even really a Republican is just whacking through candidates who would match up well against Hillary Clinton. So I think they were pretty happy to have it, and I think this memo was in some ways a response to the idea that Donald Trump was going to be some sort of a pushover. And one of the things it says in that memo is, I would add 3 or 4 points to Donald Trump in any poll you see.
Right.
As you know, as it turned out, if they had done that in all the swing states, they wouldn't have been surprised on election night.
Yeah.
And so this was a prescient thing that one of her advisors had sent around and basically found the circular file, the wastebasket at the campaign headquarters. Nobody really paid any attention to what this advisor had to say.
There's a really kind of extraordinary moment I just wanted to ask you about during the debate. Well, there's so many extraordinary moments, and this was so surreal, where she's prepping for the debates with Donald Trump, and there's this this person named, is it Philippe Reynes?
Philippe Reynes.
Okay, Philippe Reynes. Not a sycophant. Knew how to get in her face. And this is such an interesting part of the story. The role that he plays in wanting to play the role of Donald Trump in these preps. I just think it was, I'm not sure what it says exactly, except for he really wanted to get this right. But would you just tell this story?
Yeah, so he, they're looking for the right person to play Trump. And A couple of people had suggested him, I think, because he knows her very well. He had been her longtime communications advisor and spokesman, dating back to her years in the Senate. He went on to be her spokesman and advisor, senior advisor at the State Department. So he knows her really well. He'd worked on the 08 campaign as well. And he's not afraid to push her buttons in any way. And that was appealing to a lot of people because they wanted someone who could, you know, put her on the spot and also, you know, talk about anything that Trump might bring up, from, you know, the allegations of Bill Clinton's affairs you know, to anything else that they thought would be like a hot button kind of issue. And so they pick him, and he takes it very seriously. He wants to look exactly like him, but not like the Saturday Night Live version of Donald Trump. So he calls Nordstrom, and he gets a suit made, and he gets a red tie and even the cufflinks and a watch and he even at one point puts on self-tanner before one prep session to see if it would work. And he thought that it was a little too gimmicky, so he decided not to do it. But he took it very seriously. He even goes to great lengths to keep the briefing book attached to him at all times. So he goes online and finds bondage gear to kind of strap the briefing book to him so he won't forget it in a taxi cab or something. So he, you know, and he is, he's really in the sessions taking the job so seriously. And in one session, she's so frustrated and annoyed by what he's done that she's rocking visibly. And she turns to him and she's like, God, he's so annoying. He's so annoying. And he thinks that he's succeeded because he's not sure if she's talking about Donald Trump or him.
Let me ask you, at what point, because you write about this extremely painful moment when it starts to dawn on Hillary Clinton and the entire campaign that they're not going to win. And you write in those last crucial hours, though, that she was surprisingly calm. Just give us a sense of what's going on that night as it begins to dawn on them.
Well, I think that, you know, the big thing was Florida. When Florida numbers started coming in, you know, after 7 o'clock, there were a couple of people who were in Florida who started sending up, you know, warning signs. One of them was a guy named Steve Shale, who had worked on the Obama campaigns, and he was talking to a couple of his buddies in the Clinton boiler room in Midtown Manhattan, and basically saying, like, you guys, these numbers are terrible. You guys are going to lose Florida. And what he was saying, not that her numbers were so bad, but that Trump's numbers were so good. So big. There were so many counties in Florida where, you know, where Clinton had outdone Barack Obama by a little bit, and Donald Trump had outrun Mitt Romney by a lot. And so once they start to realize that Florida is going down, they know that their paths to the presidency is getting narrowed, and that some of the things that were going on in Florida could be replicated in North Carolina and Pennsylvania and some of the other states she needed to win the presidency. So you kind of think about it as like a slow boil. I mean, there's this initial look at these numbers and they're like, oh my God, if this plays out across the rest of the country, the way it's playing out in Florida, similar voters in other parts of the country, similar counties in other states, this is going to be a problem. So to just sort of fast forward a little bit, you know, in the book, we go through this series of calls between the White House and the Clinton campaign, because there's a point late in the evening where the White House determines that that she's a goner, that she's not going to win. President Obama calls Clinton and says, you need to concede.
Right.
And this is the point, you know, where their interests have diverged. He is now responsible for the country and the smooth transition of power. And she, of course, wants to see all of the results that come in from these states that are so close to see if it's possible that the winner reverses or that maybe there's a recount triggered in the morning. Obama tells her she needs to concede. He obviously doesn't think he's completely gotten the message across, because John Podesta goes out, her campaign chairman, and tells her victory party, I say victory in quotation marks, at the Javits Center in New York. He goes out and says, well, we're going to wait till morning and, you know, miracles happen or whatever. So Obama calls Podesta, who had worked for him in the White House, and is like, you guys, like, stop doing this. You can't let this thing dragged out. We got to get the – Donald Trump has been questioning the legitimacy of the election for weeks and weeks. We can't be the ones doing that now. We need to, you know, Secretary Clinton needs to concede. Well, while he's on the phone with Podesta around that time, she decides that she's going to concede. She cuts off the staff-level debate about what they should do. She says, give me the phone. I'm calling him. They get Trump on the line. She says those words she thought she would never say. Congratulations, Donald.
Yeah.
And then they have this, minute-long phone conversation. He says she ran a good campaign. And then right as she's sitting down to look at her concession speech for the first time, and I should note she had gone over her victory speech way earlier in the night thinking that she would be delivering that, she's now looking at her concession speech for the first time, and Huma Abedin, her closest aide, walks up with a phone and says, it's the president.
Right.
And she realizes in this moment this is the consolation call from President Obama to the nominee of the losing party. This is really the official end. And she knows that she has let herself down, obviously. She has let her party down. She believes she's let the country down in Donald Trump becoming president. And as someone who believed that Barack Obama had done a better job than he got credit for as president, she really believed she'd let Barack Obama down.
Yeah.
And she winced when she was told that he was on the line and was reluctant to take the phone. And she finally takes the phone and she puts it to her ear and she says, Mr. President, I'm sorry.
It's the moment you say that crystallized everything for Hillary. I wanted to ask you guys finally about how she's changed since the campaign. She said she was sorry then, but then in interviews she kept circling back to whether it was James Comey or whether it was Russia or whether it was these different kinds of things. You say that – you write about how about a month after the election she went to Washington for Harry Reid's send-off party and that her demeanor had changed. Someone said that she is the – I think un-president is how they
put it. That's right.
Let me ask you to say, finally, where is she these days? And I mean, she said this was that was her last campaign. Do you believe it? And where is she these days, do you think?
I don't think that she will run for office again. I don't think that she will run. And that includes for mayor of New York. That's the next big rumor. But I do think that she wants to play an active role in politics and be involved in it. And so she started a political action committee and she'll do what it takes to campaign for candidates and make sure that Democrats have what they need. But, I think she's trying to figure out what she wants to do personally and what that will look like. And she's still figuring it out, according to our sources.
That's Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. Their book is called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.